Hi, hi, Shalom Aleichem. Welcome back. Yeah, hope you had a good trip. Yeah, Baruch Hashem. Thank you. Yeah.
Rabbi, I'm sorry for...
Yeah.
Did the Rabbi get...
Yeah,
I just want to make sure that...
Thank you. By the way, I have to go to America for a short period. I'm not going to be here next week. But.
Yeah. How are we going to survive without the Rabbi?
Well, they survived without you, Kal Vachomer, but... But it's just...
We're actually happy when it is.
It's just, just one Sunday.
It's like when I'm out, it's like Daddy's out of the house. All the pillow fights start.
I hear. Okay. Hi, everybody. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Baruch Hashem, thank you.
Shavuot Tov.
That's such a big book. Why is that big book?
All right. It's cooking.
Oh, cookbook. Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll announce it again, but I unfortunately I have to make a very short trip to the United States, so I will not be here next Sunday, but
really?
God willing, I'll be here. I'll be here the Sunday after that. So, okay.
Where in the United States?
New York, New Jersey. Right. So it's just short. You know, I have a son in Baltimore. But the trip is so short, I literally can't even make it to Baltimore.
Can he come see you?
We're debating. I hope so, but yeah, I'm not sure. So. Okay. Alrighty, anyway, hope everyone's having a good week. Are we ready? Okay,
I have a random question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How many hours a day are you supposed to devote to davening?
What?
I just read here in my notes. The Rebbe advised people to devote 2 hours a day to davening. Apparently, that's wrong.
That was prepping for davening.
Yeah.
No, that's both prepping and davening.
Only for
chakras.
Right.
Yeah.
2 hours
for chakras. That includes the preparation. You mean?
Correct.
Yeah, you're supposed to.
No, I was going to say the Alter Rebbe has a Alter Rebbe actually had a letter to the first generation of Chabad Hasidim. That their chakras should take at least an hour. He didn't mention the preparation, but he did say
the
service should be at least an hour. And he even said he's going to send spies to be sure that they don't rush.
Rose, you missed it.
Yeah.
I heard it. That's my conclusion. Not actually dominating, it's the preparation. The Hasidus count.
Yes, it does.
That's why we learned Hasidus in the morning.
Because the spiritual preparation for prayer is part of prayer.
It's 2 hours a day. Right.
We don't have an ideal schedule.
I daven and then I do.
With some halachos with Rabbi Hood and Rabbi Weinberg.
Yes, again, if I do fall asleep in the middle, please forgive me. I just literally have not stopped running since early in the morning, but okay. Okay, anyway, we are continuing, and I hope you're not getting bored with it, but there's still a lot more to talk about. We are talking about having children, which is not at all a boring topic, and the various scientific ways of having children and the various halachic questions that arise when you utilize science. Again, Judaism, and it's not only Hasidus, but Hasidus in particular, but really all Judaism, views scientific knowledge and wisdom as also coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, coming from God. Unlike some other traditions that basically say that science is contravening the will of God, because you're having children, you know, in an unnatural way, we believe the other way around. If Hashem gave us wisdom and options and ways of doing things, then it was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will that we use them in a proper way, but we have to follow the boundaries of halacha, meaning instead of simply saying can't do it because it's a scientific innovation. We start off with the idea you can do it, but you then have to look at the various halachic issues that arise. It's a very, very different orientation than to simply condemn new technology just because it's new. It's the other way around. It is part of the unfolding of divine wisdom coming into the world that Hashem makes the chachma available. I mean, it's like saying, if they discovered or invented the polio vaccine in 1953, whatever it was, what are you going to say? I mean, is a Jew going to say, oh, babies before 1953 died of polio, so who are we to change God's will and use vaccines to save children's lives? Now, I don't know why Hashem didn't give us the wisdom to invent the polio vaccine before 1954, or whenever, 53, but once it was given to us, there becomes an obligation to use whatever. In fact, Chabad is especially very, very big on this, you know, with the development of the internet and development of, they were the first ones, generally speaking. Hasidic communities are very, very small-c conservative. You know, they don't like to change things. You know, old customs we have for hundreds of years, we don't want to change things. But the Rebbe's view always was that if new things come into the world that can be used for the glory of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then we're supposed to use them. That's why Chabad is such a wonderful website that I myself use quite often. Because the idea is, we embrace technology because we can also use it to serve Hashem and to make the, as the immortal phrase, to make a dira b'tachtonim, to make a dwelling place for God in the lowly world that we have. So what we talked about the past few weeks is we talked about what you might call plain vanilla reproductive technology, and that simply means husband's sperm. Yeah, that would have been fired up. husband's sperm and wife's egg, and we talked about stem cell research and the like. I now want to talk about the use of third parties. Now, we did talk about one aspect of this. We did talk about artificial insemination from a sperm donor, and I think we went through the issues there. But let's talk about changes that come from the woman's side of the equation. And in particular, the two that I'm going to talk about tonight are really the same thing except in reverse. There's this mirror image. And that is egg donation, or the converse of that is gestational surrogacy. In other words, the common denominator is egg is from one woman and the woman that carries the baby is somebody else. But that can come in two flavors. One might be, again, let's look at this from the perspective of a Jewish couple, because that's our target group. A Jewish man and a Jewish woman want to have a child. Now, if the Jewish woman is not ovulating for whatever reason, but she does have a womb, she does have a uterus, so one possibility would be egg donation, in which another woman, and we'll discuss Jew or non-Jew, donates the egg. The egg is fertilized in vitro, and that fertilized embryo is then transplanted into the Jewish woman's uterus. Right, so that would be egg donation. So egg donation is something that would be used when the woman has ovulation problems, but she does have a womb, she does have a uterus, and is able to hold, to maintain a pregnancy. Now, gestational surrogacy is just the opposite. That is where the Jewish woman ovulates, but let's say she's unable to sustain a pregnancy. Perhaps there's a partial hysterectomy in which the ovaries might still be there, but there's no uterus or the like. Such a thing is actually possible. So the problem there is the Jewish woman ovulates. There's an egg, which could be fertilized in vitro, but it then would be carried by a mother. That's called the gestational surrogacy. Now, there is a third type of surrogacy, which is actually more common, but halakhically it's not particularly complicated, and that is sometimes the surrogates, in fact, most cases of surrogacy, the surrogate is also the egg donor, which actually means, if you go back, maybe this is when you were very young, but if you remember, the first big surrogacy case that made it to the public's attention involved a woman, Mary Beth Whitehead, and Dr. I don't remember his first name, but Elizabeth Stern. It actually involved the Jewish couple. And what happened was, as they had entered into agreement, where Mary Beth Whitehead, who was a married woman, would carry the pregnancy and then deliver the baby over to the Stearns for adoption. But in the case of Mary Beth Whitehead, although Dr. Stern, the man, the husband, the Jewish husband, was the sperm provider, but Mary Beth Whitehead was both the egg donor and the woman who carried the baby. Right, so that's complete surrogacy. So I guess just to be, now again, that's not particularly, I mean, that's not a good thing to do, but it's not halachically particularly complicated, as you'll see. So let's analyze, I guess let's analyze all three scenarios. Let's analyze egg donation, let's analyze gestational surrogacy, and let's analyze, I don't know what the name of the other one is, Mary Beth Whitehead surrogacy, in which the surrogate, they call it rent-a-womb sometimes, is both the genetic egg donor and the one that carries the baby. Okay, so let's of those three, the most common within a religious community, if at all, is egg donation. No? Because egg donation, the idea is that the Jewish woman carries the baby for 9 months, but there's a donated egg. The halachic problem with egg donation is very, very significant. And it's a problem that sometimes people don't even ask their rabbis about. Because egg donation is such a low-key process, meaning to say, the Jewish woman carries the baby for 9 months, and nobody even knows, egg donor, not egg donor. It's a very, very anonymous process. And yet it raises really severe halachic problems, perhaps more so than a sperm donation. And the reason that's so is, all of us know that it's axiomatic that whether or not a child is Jewish does not depend on the father. Whether or not the child is Jewish depends on the mother. Jewish law is based on what is called matrilineal descent. Right? Everybody knows that. It is true that the Reform movements changed in quotation marks, changed that rule, but they did so by basically saying, we don't follow halacha. The halacha cannot be changed. The halacha is absolutely clear that if a non-Jewish man has a child from a Jewish woman, the child is not half Jewish, the child is whole Jewish. And the other way around, if a Jewish man has a child from a non-Jewish woman, the child is not half Jewish, the child is 100% non-Jewish. There is no such category in Jewish law as being a half Jew. There is no such thing. You are either a Jew or you're not a Jew, but you have the ability to convert to Judaism. Okay? And, oh, thank you. I was nervous about that. And so this is called matrilineal descent, right? You've all heard of, and you all know, matrilineal descent. Okay. So that's very simple. But when you have an egg donor situation, your question immediately becomes, okay, whether or not the kid is Jewish depends on the mother, but who is the mother halachically in an egg donor situation? Let us assume, for example, that you have a Jewish couple and they get an egg donation. And in the United States, if it's an anonymous egg donation, there is a halachic assumption. But you know this halachic rule? That when you're not certain what something is, you assign it to the majority classification. Now, in the United States, there are many, many more Gentiles than Jews. So if a couple receives an anonymous egg donation, meaning they don't know who the donor is, halacha says that we assume that it is from the majority population, which is non-Jewish. So, very simple question. Whether a child is Jewish or not depends on the mother, but who is the mother? Is the mother the egg donor, who, after all, is the genetic contributor of 50% of the genetic endowment of the child? Or is it the gestational mother who carried the baby for 9 months? Because, this would be very surprising, because if halacha assigns maternal identity to the genetic mother, that would mean a baby that is born from a Jewish woman, carried in her womb for 9 months, would halachically need a conversion because it was born a non-Jew. It's almost like a trivial pursuit question. Give me a case where a child can be born from a Jewish mother and need a conversion. Answer, according to one view, if it is from a donated egg from a non-Jewish source. Now, so this has to be resolved one way or the other. I mean, you understand the issue here. If maternity is based on genetic contribution, then the child would be not Jewish. If maternity is based on gestation, then the child would be Jewish, notwithstanding the non-Jewish origin. Very, very important question. Now, this is discussed, and there are different ways of looking at it. One might ask from a spiritual point, well, what determines whether a child has a Jewish soul? Now, there is a famous Gemara, which actually the Bala Tanya, the Alter Rebbe, references in the very, very beginning of Tanya, although he doesn't give you the whole Gemara. Right? You remember, everyone remembers the first line in Perek Aleph of Tanya, that Tanya, we learned in a Braita, that we make a neshama, a nefesh, swear before it comes into the world that it will be a tzaddik and will not be a rasha. Right? Everyone knows that, right? That's, even if you don't get to chapter 2 of Tanya, everybody gets to chapter 1 of Tanya, right? So everyone knows the beginning. Right? Okay. You didn't do chapter 1 of Tanya? No, you must have. I'm sure you did. But
make me feel better. That's okay.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. Fine.
If you have to hear Tanya from me, here. Okay, anyway. Now, the thing is this, though. The Alter Rebbe is actually starting in the middle of a longer passage, because that was relevant to what he was talking about. But the passage immediately before that, which this is the middle of, is talking about the idea, and I hope you've learned this as well, that when a baby is in the womb of his mother, his or her mother, the baby is taught the whole Torah from an angel. And the baby absorbs all of the Torah. And when the baby is born, so why don't babies get born knowing, you know, the Talmud, you know? Actually, they say, okay, I'll tell you a story about that. So they say that the angel hits the baby on the lip. And that's the indentation on the lip. So non-Jewish babies also learn, so they don't learn the whole Torah, but they learn the Noahide laws and the idea of God.
Christians believe that as well, though.
Do they really?
Yeah, because
I didn't ever hear that, really.
No, for sure, because when I was in Marseille, they had like a very big, like at the old port, and they had like a baby, like human thing or whatever, and there's a little note at the bottom that he was the angel that went.
Well, it's interesting, you know, if I could tell you, you know, in the Mary Poppins book, if you ever read Mary Poppins as a child.
Yes,
in the movie. So, yeah, but this I think is not in the movie. This is only in the book. So they had a similar, it's not the same idea exactly, but the author had this idea that until babies learn to talk, they understand all sorts of things. They understand the animals, they understand about God, they understand all sorts of ideas. Once they learn to talk, they forget it. Now that's a little different, but it's a similar idea.
Jesus, all of child psychology probably adds.
Yes. That was the whole thing. In fact, the story is quite a moving story, and it resonates with me somewhat, because it kind of says that sometimes when children are crying, like in that story, it's because a bird told the child, you know, in 6 months you're not going to understand me anymore. So the baby starts bawling, and the parents are saying, why is he crying? Why is he crying?
You know?
Right. The baby is crying because the robin said, you know, we're not going to be able to talk anymore. Now there actually is even in Kabbalah such an idea that before a child has speech, it is somehow more connected to God in a way that's uncommunicable. But okay, but putting that aside, this is a very famous teaching of Chazal, that a baby learns the Torah in the mother's womb, and then it forgets it. By the way, they tell stories, I don't know, this might be Baba Mises, they tell stories that once in a while, a kid is born without the indentation. So you have this newborn baby who is like quoting the Rambam, you know, whatever it is. And I've heard stories, and what always happens is like the baby. What always happens is the baby like dies a day later, like he's recalled by the factory, kind of, you know. But yeah, that's the story, like, you know.
Yeah.
They're born without an indentation, and okay. So the reason why this is relevant is this: if the notion of the maternal environment is so significant for the spiritual identity of the child, then that would be an argument, halachically even, right? That the mother should not be the only person who gave an egg. The mother should be the one that carried the baby for 9 months, because that determined the spiritual interaction of that baby with Hashem. So if you took that position, right, so your argument might be, and I'll give you, okay, it's not for us just to make up arguments, I'm just giving you a logical, well, I'll give you psychologue in a moment. That would argue that an egg donated, you know, a donated egg carried in a Jewish mother would not need conversion, because the identity was determined by the angel teaching Torah. On the other hand, from a physicalist standpoint, one might say that a gestational womb is less significant to the individuality of the child than is the egg, because the egg determines, right? The egg has the DNA and all of the characteristics. The womb is an environment. I mean, theoretically, we could create, we haven't done it yet, but we might create an artificial womb. So what are you going to say? If everything is based on gestation, that would mean a child born from an artificial womb wouldn't be human, which would be pretty strange. Or, if God forbid, we ever put human embryos into animals, which is a theoretical possibility. You can use a cow womb to gestate a human embryo. Is that little cute little human baby going to be called a cow? In other words, what I'm saying is... What I'm saying is,
they're clearly not his friends, and if your friends are calling you that, yeah, you should reconsider, yeah, this.
In other words, what I'm saying is that on one hand, and of course, does the angel teach human embryos that are gestated in animals? What does the angel? I mean, how does the spiritual forces interact with that? These, by the way, are no. I mean, only a mad scientist would do it, but there are mad scientists, and this is certainly within the realm of technical possibility. So there's a real difficult problem here, because with egg donation, we introduce the concept of what we might call split maternity. In the olden days, you were either a mother or you weren't a mother. If you were a Jewish, if you were Jewish, and you were the mother, kid is Jewish. If you were not Jewish, kid was not Jewish. And who the mother was never a big question. Throughout most of history, we always knew who the mother was.
Can we ask? Can I ask about kind of sure. Because I have a few friends that are Reformed. And they're very, their fathers are Jewish,
yes,
and their mothers aren't.
Yes.
Very much kind of going down the.
That's correct.
I'm very Jewish. Da da da. Because the whole idea of even going down the maternal side has like changed over history. I don't know.
Well, it has changed over history, but the history was before Mount Sinai and after Mount Sinai. Meaning they have a point in the sense that before Matan Torah, mm-hmm, Ramban writes, Nachmanides writes, that Jewish identity was defined patrilineally.
It was.
Yes, before.
That's,
yeah, but we're talking. This is before Matan Torah, right, but from the time the Torah was given, it was redefined matrilineally. So I suppose if they want to be pedantic, they could say that was a change, but that was a change that existed from the time of Moses. It's a pretty early change.
Not like 100 years ago.
That's no.
Right, this is what I mean. That's what I was...
Well, the Reform movement doesn't accept that it's from Moses, but even the Reform movement says historically it dates from Ezra. Now, Ezra is around 300 BCE. So even the Reform movement's historical analysis, even if they're correct, which I believe they are not, but even if they are correct that Ezra created the rule, it is a pretty, pretty old rule.
Where is it derived from, though?
Well, it's a bit of a complicated derivation. The derivation basically is that the Torah says, when the Torah warns us not to let our children marry the Canaanites, so it says that if your daughter marries a Canaanite, your grandson will no longer be serving Hashem.
If
my daughter marries a Canaanite, so my Jewish grandson will no longer be worshiping God. He'll become idolatrous. Mm. But the implication is, why does it only say if your daughter marries a Canaanite? Why doesn't it say if your son marries a Canaanite? Answer, because if your son marries a Canaanite, it's not your grandson at all, because he's a guy. It's kind of an implication in that particular way. So, as I say, this is a very, very serious question, because I will tell you, I know from personal knowledge that many Orthodox women who have egg donations do not even ask a rabbi about this at all. The child is just born, and the child is raised Jewish, and the child, unlike adoption, where I mentioned you have to tell the child, many parents don't tell their child.
Why don't they ask? Because they're embarrassed?
They don't think there's a question. In other words, people think it is so intuitively obvious that if a woman carried the baby for 9 months, it's her baby.
Really?
They don't even think it's a question. Now, I do want to point out, so let me just tell you, that unfortunately, in all of these areas, everything is a machlokas. In other words, the answer is, I'll give you an example of this. You know, a young rabbi became a rabbi of a synagogue. And you know, in the synagogue davening, there's a lot of special weeks in the year, like a holiday week or Rosh Chodesh or the week before Rosh Chodesh, in which sometimes you say things, sometimes you don't. It's a little confusing. But what do you say, what don't you say? So sometimes they fight in a shul. People disagree. What do you say, what do you not say? So the young rabbi, this was his first position, and there was some question whether a certain prayer be said, and the rabbi really wasn't so sure. He was hoping that the elders of the congregation knew what to do. So some elders are yelling, "Say it!" And some elders are saying, "Don't say it!" And finally the rabbi says, "Can't somebody tell me what the custom of the congregation is?" He says, "Yes, the custom is we argue over it every year. That is our minhag. Our minhag is that we disagree over this." So in many areas of halacha, there are some major disagreements. There are some views that assign maternity based on gestation, because of this idea of the angel teaching the Torah. There are some views.
But if angel teaches Torah to everyone, then...
No, I understand, but the theory, I understand that, but the theory would be that since your spiritual identity is based on what the angel does during your gestation, if you are in a Jewish body during gestation, our assumption is the angel is teaching you the Jewish Torah, not the non-Jewish Torah. See, the non-Jew does not learn the Jewish Torah. The non-Jew learns the Noahide.
Yeah, but maybe
laws.
The angel teaches according to DNA.
Well, that's a possibility. But these people feel it's more plausible that the angel connects based on the identity of the host. The host is the environment, and that's the environment in which the spiritual nefesh, the godly soul, is formed. Through the infusion of that divine knowledge and the like. Yeah.
Now, in Israel, do you just assume that the child is Jewish? Like,
say again?
The egg donor? Can you assume
yes. That's 100% correct, because once again, the rule is exactly consistent. Any anonymous donation is assumed to come from the majority subset of the population. In the United States, most other countries, that would be non-Jewish. In Israel, the assumption would be Jewish. But even then, there'll be some other problems I'll get to and the like. But at least the Jewish and non-Jewish, which means, according to some opinions, the child is a Jew and does not need a conversion. According to other opinions, the child is non-Jewish and needs a conversion.
The opinions are like different levels of Judaism in terms of modern orthodoxy?
Well, the Reform would certainly accept them, because the Reform... if the father is Jewish, it'll accept him because of that alone. I don't know if the Reform has an official position on egg donation, but my guess would be they would simply follow the birth mother.
Mm-hmm. Adoption.
Yeah, I assume so.
The way you ask the kids to.
So as a practical matter, I would have to advise a woman, a Jewish woman, that had a child from a non-Jewish egg donor, that the child should undergo a conversion. Now this is an unusual category. I don't know if I mentioned this particular term before. This is called Giyur Misafek. Giyur Misafek means a conversion out of doubt, which means if we're not sure if somebody is a born Jew or a born non-Jew, So if they're a born Jew, they wouldn't need a conversion. If they're a born non-Jew, they would be like an adopted child that would need a conversion. So to play it safe, we convert. And it is written in the document that this is a conversion out of doubt. Now, this picture comes up a lot of times, even without the exotic case of egg donation. This will come up, in fact, if you want to make aliyah, if anybody here happens to have had a conversion, what often happens in Israel is that the chief rabbinate does not always accept conversions. And I don't mean conservative reform conversions. I mean Orthodox conversions, because they say they don't know the rabbis, they can't verify rabbis, etc. If you're not on the approved list, half of whose members are dead, by the way, but if you're not on the approved list, well, once you're dead, you can't be on a basement anymore, but the rabbinate
they could update the list.
Yeah, the rabbinate compiled a list a number of years ago, and a lot of the people on the list are literally not here anymore, and one of them on the list is in jail, but okay.
Is that the American one?
The American one. Yeah.
I think I heard that story.
Yeah, I'm talking about
Right. How people were obtaining conversion.
Yeah. No. This is because of breach of tsnias
in DC.
Yeah. Okay. That's my community. Okay. Anyway, the point is this. So I want to point out, I just want to warn people that even if your conversion is 1,000,000% good, 100% good, sometimes you have to reconvert Israel.
It's horrible,
because the Israeli rabbin, and I don't blame them totally, because their basic position is, hey, you know, there are 1,000,000 rabbis out there. We do not personally know every rabbi, and we cannot check into every person. So they'll often say, hey, if we don't know you, you're not on our list. And how do you get on the list is a good question, but you're not on the list, so just do it again. So that's also called Giyur Misafek, meaning you're really Jewish, but we just, because of the doubt, we do it.
Do you have to wait for like a 3-year process again?
Yes, you do. Well, it doesn't mean you have to wait 3 years. No. You have to go to the mikveh. Yeah, yeah.
For kids, then it's a lot easier.
No. I'm talking for kids, but I'm talking about for an adult.
Yeah.
We're talking about two different things.
So if you already spent 3 years going through the conversion.
What about what the Ethiopian Jews went through? I read that it was considered symbolic conversion.
Okay, symbolic conversion is a polite way to say that there were doubts about their...
Yeah, it is. Okay.
Yeah. Symbolic conversion sounds much nicer. Suffolk means we're not sure if you're Jewish.
I don't think it sounds nice.
Well, symbolic.
The same happened to
Okay. Yeah. So, Giyormi Suffolk is a tool that is used in a lot of places. By the way, I want to tell you something that one has to be attuned to psychology sometimes here, too. Let me give you an actual case. When I first became a rabbi in my community around 25 years ago, so there was a wonderful, wonderful family, and family had daughters, teenage daughters, and it turns out that their grandmother, the mother's mother, was a non-Jew who converted to Judaism, let's say in 1940. And as a result, the mother, her daughter, was Jewish, and her children were Jewish. But it turned out that some people, not me, but some people were raising questions that her mother, the one who converted, was not always meticulous in keeping Shabbos. So although she had an Orthodox conversion, some people were raising questions that perhaps grandmother's conversion wasn't valid, which would mean, in other words, that mother was not Jewish. Others, her daughter.
Why did they say the grandmother's conversion wasn't Jewish?
Because there were times in her life where she was not meticulous in keeping Shabbos.
Once you convert, you have to be.
So there was a theory that the argument was that she did not totally accept the commandments when she converted.
But you can't. So you're telling me that if there are people that say that get converted under the London Baked Din or something, which is technically modern Orthodox and above.
Yes.
And they then choose to.
No, that's very different. Let me make this clear. If a converted Jew later chooses not to keep the commandments.
Right.
Their conversion is 100% valid.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Okay.
But here, the argument, somebody investigated, I don't know why, somebody investigated and was concerned that from the very beginning of this woman's conversion, she wasn't keeping Shabbos.
Okay.
In fact, the other way around. By the time I came, the grandmother was keeping Shabbos, but they're going back to the... So, as a result, the teenage daughters, actually they're a little older, they're like early 20s, there was some difficulty in Shidduchim because people said, well, we're not really sure of their Jewish status. So I thought cavalierly to simply tell them, listen, your grandmother is 100% fine with me. I consider her Jewish. Your mother is Jewish. But, you know, what's the big deal? If you just want to be sure, go to the mikveh again, and that way there's going to be no doubt. Now, that sounds, you know, from a male perspective, that's rational, simple, common sense answer.
I feel so hurt.
They almost had a nervous breakdown, because essentially what was being communicated to them was, you think you were Jewish? Nope. The 20 years of your life and the 40 years of your mother's life and the 40 years since your grandmother's conversion was all, I mean, I wasn't saying that, but that's what they hear, was all a fake and no good, and all the things you did and all the Torah you learned and all the mitzvahs you did don't count. Which means you can't just pull out, a rav cannot just pull out the idea, reconvert, what's the big deal? So although my solution was eminently practical, but one has to, understand that to communicate to somebody, to cast aspersions on their Jewish identity is a very, very, very serious, very, very serious thing. But be it as it may, whatever, things got sorted out eventually in that. But it was an important lesson that, the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish laws, it has four parts. But there's an old tradition, there's actually a fifth part of the Shulchan Aruch, which is oral, it's not in writing. And the fifth part is the common sense of how to relate to people in a way that does not hurt them. And that's the fifth part of the Shulchan Aruch.
That's why it's not written.
That's correct. Because that changes. Of course, what do I tell you? I'll tell you a story that somebody claimed there was a sixth part. The story goes...
That's all psychological.
A great rabbi ordained his student and he tested him on all the four parts of the Shulchan Aruch. And he said, be sure you know the fifth part, how to relate to people well and how not to be, insulting and condescending. And that's the fifth part. Do you know the fifth part? He says, oh yes, I know the fifth part. Anyway, the rabbi got his job and within a year he was fired because he got into fights with everybody. So his teacher said to him, I thought you said you knew the fifth part of the Shulchan Aruch. How could you get into so many fights with people? He says, Rebbe, I do know the fifth part of the Shulchan Aruch, how to deal with people. But how do you deal with people who aren't people? That's the sixth part. That's the part I never learned, The people who were fighting with me weren't even human. He said, that's already, all right. So he said, that's another part of the Shulchan Aruch that you have to know. That one I didn't do. Yep.
I don't know if this is true at all, but I just heard, just in passing kind of thing, something to do with, conversion, if they went to, a Jewish school and had Jewish education, and, all their lives and things like that, they're kind of counting the...
Okay, so again,
I'm just asking, because if you're saying that this girl, let's say, was raised Jewish,
yeah.
20 years...
Okay, well, it makes no difference. She could have kept... She was an Orthodox Jew. She kept all the mitzvahs for 20 years. But if she didn't go to the mikveh... She didn't have a conversion ceremony. In other words, her whole Jewish status is based on her grandmother. You see what I'm saying? In other words, there's no concept you become Jewish automatically just because you kept the commandments.
Mm.
You have to have the mikvah unless you were born from a Jewish mother. Now, if grandma's conversion is not valid, then mother was not Jewish.
Yeah.
If mother was not Jewish, then daughter is not Jewish, even though she was keeping the commandments for 20 years. Nobody... No. So I said, since you're religious, you can just convert today. It'll take 5 minutes. Which it would only take 5 minutes. I said, I would convert you right now. But you see...
We do now, community.
But psychologically, it was very devastating because it gave him the message. Huh? There were five sisters. Three of them converted, two of them did not. It was interesting. They took different positions.
They decided they don't
want to
be religious, or they
were... No. All five were religious. But the ones who decided to convert said, if there's any question, we want to get rid of the question. And the other said, we don't accept that there's any question. Well, you're 100% correct. That is a hidden cost, because once you undergo even a superfluous conversion. You cannot marry a kohen. That's correct.
Then you change your name. You're Basara instead of.
Then you're Basara, and then you cannot marry a kohen. So there are. It's not a cost. It's not a.
How should instead of like Bas, your mother's Rivka, like Bas Rivka.
We do keep them. The only thing is that we sometimes determine that people who think they're kohens may not be kohens, and that sometimes is something we discover.
Like for example.
Well, let me give you a simple. Let me give you a simple example. If a kohen marries a divorced woman, which he's not allowed to do, the child he has is no longer a kohen. So it ends then. In other words, so that child could actually marry a divorced woman. You see, there are ways, I mean, not permissible ways, but there are ways that kahuna does not get passed down to the next generation. In fact, that is why, well, let me give you the simplest example, an extreme example. If a kohen marries a non-Jewish woman, which he's not allowed to do, not a convert, a kohen marries a non-Jewish woman, which of course is a sin, the child is not only not a kohen, the child's not Jewish. So if he converts, he doesn't become a kohen, he just becomes a regular converted Jew. The Kohen's line ends. That is why, you know, they found a genetic marker.
If he marries a convert, is the kid Kohen?
No. The kid is Jewish, but not a Kohen. Not a Kohen.
It's not,
in other words, if a Kohen, any woman a Kohen cannot marry, will end the line. So again, to summarize, I know we said this a few times, but to summarize, the women a Kohen cannot marry. A Kohen cannot marry a divorced woman. He could marry a widow. A Kohen cannot marry a woman that had sexual relations with a goy, with a Gentile.
Why?
It's halacha. The Torah says that he can only live, that once a woman has been with a Gentile, she is not able to be with a Kohen. You know, we don't necessarily have a reason, but there's been a certain desecration of holiness. And a Kohen cannot marry a converted woman. So those are the big three, right? A Kohen cannot marry a divorced woman, that means through a get, a Jewish divorced woman. A Kohen cannot marry someone that had relations with a non-Jew. A Kohen cannot marry a convert. If a Kohen marries any of those three women, he doesn't lose it. The children that are born are no longer Kohanim. The line is ended. At that point,
could a rabbi marry them, or is it like totally?
A rabbi is not allowed to officiate at a prohibited marriage. If a kohen is marrying a woman that a kohen is not allowed to marry, a rabbi is not allowed to officiate at that marriage. I mean, if a kohen wants to marry a divorced woman, if I know this is a divorced woman and I know he's a kohen, I am not allowed to marry them. They will not be able to get married. They'll have to get married. They shouldn't get married. But if they're going to get married, it could only be civilly, or once again, conservative or reform will do it. But an Orthodox rabbi will not.
No,
you're 100% correct. People lie all the time. You're 100% correct. A typical rabbi does not have the ability to investigate what people tell him. Basically, we rely on what people say. We ask them questions, and we have to assume that they're giving us honest answers.
Then later find out.
Well, it's a sinful marriage, whatever. But you know, it's between them and God at that point.
Exactly, the kid is still not going to be Kohen.
Yeah, the kid is not a Kohen,
and he thinks he's a Kohen. He's still not.
Right? Yeah. Now, let me emphasize the idea. Yeah.
It's sad. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm feeling sad.
Like, she asks you these questions.
Yep.
She would ask if you can marry a Kohen.
Yes.
And you would say.
You should try to listen. You should try to be honest. I understand that once you have a relationship with a kohen and then you learn these halachas, that can be very, very hard. I understand that.
What happened?
But if you haven't yet met the kohen, you might as well say, "I can't marry a kohen." I mean, there's no reason. In other words, I am sympathetic to somebody who's engaged and then they learn a new halacha that they can't marry the kohen. That's a real, real hard situation. But if you're not there yet, you might as well keep the halacha.
You're finding your heart again. You're touching it.
Well, the way, there's no way to get around it. But what we sometimes can determine by investigation is that the person who thinks he's a Kohen is actually not a Kohen because there's some divorce in the background or whatever it is. So that does happen sometimes, that a person who thought he was a Kohen is actually not a Kohen. And although that's normally a bad thing, but in this case it's a good thing. You know, it's a bad thing or you're not a Kohen, but it actually works out well in these types of cases. By the way, the last name Cohen does not mean you're a Cohen at all. First of all, as I say, your family name could be Cohen, but maybe there's a divorce in the background, etc. You know. So, and second of all, because Cohen was a common Jewish name in Ellis Island, you know, when immigrants used to come from Russia or Poland, right? And they would have these huge, complicated Yiddish names. And the Irish guy couldn't spell it. He would put down, "Oh, you're Jewish?" Yeah, says Cohen. You know, so a lot of people just got the name Cohen, even though you know that wasn't their name, and they weren't Kohanim to begin with. So Cohen was a name that was commonly given to Jewish people who immigrated to
America. What was the name of the guy that you said, like Stan Fried or something?
Shine Ferguson was my name.
Shine Ferguson.
Yeah. Shine Ferguson. Okay.
Shine Ferguson.
Right. I've already forgotten. Right. Okay. Right. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, there's a big rabbi in New York whose name is Rabbi David Cohen, and he's not a Cohen, so he makes sure to spell his name with a K and not with a C. So it's. You know, Khan he spells, although it's pronounced Cohen, but he pronounced K-A-H-A-N, so people shouldn't think he's a Kohen and black. And even in Hebrew.
I marry him by accident.
Well, I mean, he knows halacha. So yeah. Now, let me just emphasize again. Let me just mention one more halacha to be sure. Now, if a woman is not a virgin, but the only person she had relations with was a Jewish man, she can, and she was not divorced from him, even if she was never married, even if it was out of wedlock, she is permitted to marry a Kohen. She does not become, a Kohen does not have to marry a virgin. That is a special law only with the Kohen Gadol, and today there is no high priest, so that's not relevant. Did you said you had one more question?
So if a Kohen isn't a virgin, then he's fine, though. He doesn't have to.
Well, listen. I know the double standard issues, and you know I don't have a complete, compelling, good answer for that.
What if he sits with an non-Jew?
Let me put it this way: the biggest double standard is that the guy who works in the temple is the man. In other words, like this: these are laws that are connected to the sanctity of the person that is working in the temple. So as a result, he's going to be the one that will have all these restrictions on who he can marry. So ultimately, you might as well ask me, why can't the woman work in the temple? I mean, no, those are. I mean, once you get into that, you're going to have all of those questions. Well, okay, that the house, the home is the temple. Okay, alrighty. This is the idea. Now, this will also be relevant. Actually, this issue of who's the mother. Okay. Sometimes you got to give me a slap and say, get back. Okay. Say again, what?
Tina's time.
She's really upset.
Say again.
She's really upset.
Yeah. No, I'm happy to answer questions. But again, I hope it doesn't distract people too much. Yeah.
If a coin with a non-Jew, he doesn't lose his status.
That's correct.
Does that make sense to you?
It's a great... One second. Remember that, of course, it's a tremendous sin. It is a tremendous sin. Nobody's legitimating sin, but it does not disqualify. Okay.
So she has a more respect.
Now, okay, so what is the critical... Again, going back to egg donation, because we have to talk about that. The critical issue of egg
donation... How do we get to Cohen from egg donation?
I have no idea.
We don't go on that time.
Guillermo Suffolk, right. Now, let me point out that because of this maternity issue, it will also be relevant as to paternity. For example, this case of Cohen will be exactly the situation. If a Cohen has a child from his wife via egg donation.
Ooh, there's a problem.
Is the child a Kohen?
No.
No, so it depends.
If, we got that one right.
Right. If maternity is attributed to the egg donor, so the child needs a conversion, misafek, he will not be a Kohen. If, on the other hand, maternity is assigned to the gestational mother, then it's like his natural child. He will be a Kohen, right? So the maternity issue indirectly has a paternity aspect as well, because kahuna, whether you're a Kohen, depends on the father. But only if it's from a Jewish woman, not as from a non-Jewish woman, because when the child needs conversion, that erases any connections, right? Right? Okay. So this is a big, big issue, and because of Giyur Misafek, we would have to be strict. Now,
would he have to convert?
The child would have to convert because of this unknown status. But this creates...
He'll have to convert either way, essentially.
Yes, yes. But this raises a problem. Do you remember we discussed... Yeah, I'll get in 1 second. If you remember, we discussed about adoption, that when you adopt a non-Jewish child, the child has to convert. But do you remember that because he was, he or she was converted as a minor, when they reach bar mitzvah,
they have one day to declare,
to renounce their conversion. They don't have to go to the mikveh again, meaning if they don't renounce, they're stuck. That's not a nice way of putting it, but they're Jewish, they can't get out of it. Now, here, how does that work when the whole conversion is a giyur misafek? It's like this. If he's a convert, he could renounce. If he's a born Jew, he can't renounce. So what if this egg-donated kid...
He get half a day.
When he's 13 years old, he says, I don't want to be Jewish.
Voila.
You're stuck.
Is he stuck or is he not stuck?
He's a convert. He has a status of a convert, no?
No, because he has a status of a doubtful convert. Maybe he's a born Jew.
No.
You
can't marry a Kohen.
You could be a Jew.
No, which means you got to be strict in both ways. Meaning, we don't let you marry a Kohen if you're a girl because maybe you're a convert. But we don't let you escape because maybe you're a born Jew. In other words, when you have Giyur Misafek, you understand the concept?
Appealing.
Giyur Misafek means you gotta be strict on either side of the equation. You see what I'm saying? So that creates some real conundrums, real difficulties. And how do you deal with Giyur? Yeah, did you want to say something? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. Very, very excellent question. The general rule is that even if a baby was converted as an infant, they cannot marry a Kohen. That if they were born from... Now, there is a minority view that says if the baby was converted below the age of 3, they could marry a Kohen. Did you hear that? Yeah. But that's not the halacha. The halacha is even below the age of 3. Even if they were converted from birth. The only machlokas is, this is again, there's so many interesting questions. What if a non-Jewish woman converts when she is pregnant? A non-Jewish woman converts when she is pregnant and then gives birth to a Jewish child. Can that daughter marry a Kohen? Is that daughter considered a converted Jew?
Yes, because it's...
Or is that daughter considered a born Jew because she was born as a Jew?
Well, if we go by the egg donation, then...
Ah, very excellent. So in truth, this is very... In truth, this is very similar. Because in a sense, when you have the non-Jewish woman converting, that's exactly the situation of non-Jewish egg and Jewish gestation in a single woman. That's right. Very excellent.
Yeah.
Still
very confusing.
Like, yeah. What if it was 8.5 months pregnant? Shouldn't matter.
Right. No, because how much? Yeah, no. She's raising a good question, meaning to say how much of the gestation. Right. In other words, in the case of egg donation, you got 9 months. It's a good question. Right. That would still have to be determined. So a lot of questions here. That's why, by the way, as a general procedure, we do not convert pregnant women. That we know that they're pregnant, simply because there's kind of an unknown status of what is the status of the child. Is the child a convert, or is the child a born Jew? So as a result, we either require that a pregnant woman have a pregnancy test. I'm going to say that if we don't...
I think it's been pregnant.
What I mean, what I mean is that... meaning if she is...
just in case.
That was not said correctly. If we know she's pregnant, we will tell her to wait till after the birth. And if we don't know that she's pregnant, we will require her to have a pregnancy test. And only if it's negative will we proceed with the conversion. We generally will not
do a conversion. You also need to do a pregnancy test as well.
Yeah, we will not do a conversion of a pregnant woman because of this question. Exactly. We'll wait till she gives birth, and then we'll convert the babies. And then we'll follow the halachas of adopt.
More than 5
women.
At a
time.
Any woman wants to convert who's pregnant has twins.
Right, okay. Yeah, well, that happened with Rivka, certainly. Okay. Alrighty, so, alright.
So what can I do about the kid who...
Well, as I say, you know, the case actually hasn't come up, but the question would be, if he renounces, we would have a halachic doubt: is he now a goy or a Jew? Meaning, until now he was either a convert or a born Jew. Once he renounces, he's either a goy or a born Jew. Meaning, you'd have that suffix on a different. Suffix mean that doubt on a different plane. So these are difficult. These are difficult issues. Okay. Now let me point out. Let's talk now about gestational surrogacy. Because there's not much. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me give you. Let me talk about gestational surrogacy first, and then I'll give you a very fascinating medrash that bears on this. Gestational surrogacy is the identical problem. It's the identical problem. It's just in reverse. Meaning to say, in gestational surrogacy, the Jewish wife is giving the egg. It's being fertilized in vitro. And then it will be carried by a gestational surrogate for 9 months. Typically for, well, there are all sorts of laws and regulations. What can you pay her, etc. You know, technically you're not allowed to pay her, but you can pay your medical expenses and different things. And whatever it is. But typically,
Jewish allowed to pay the mother.
Let me point out. That's a matter of under secular law. They don't want you to pay the mother because it looks like baby selling.
Well, under halacha, how does it look?
Well, if halacha permits it at all, and I'll discuss that, halacha wouldn't prohibit exchange of money. In other words, halacha says if something is permitted, you can pay. And if something is not permitted, paying is not going to make it kosher. Mm-hmm. So according to halacha, I think the exchange of money is largely an irrelevancy. But in secular law, money is a very, very big deal. And in a lot of the surrogacies, or adoptions for that matter, you know, it is absolutely against the law to pay money to get an adopted child. You pay your lawyer, etc., but you're not allowed. Now, a lot of money goes under the table. Yeah. A lot of poor women... you know, unfortunately, who aren't able to raise a child, you know, will give up their child for adoption if they get $20,000 or the like. But that is illegal, even though it's done, yeah.
Well, I have a suggestion, thinking that if you were to pay the surrogate mother for carrying the baby,
yes,
wouldn't that somehow imply that she's not a mother since she's selling the baby in that way?
So here's the thing, you know, maybe it implies it societally, but the mere fact that the parties have assumed she's not the mother cannot change the spiritual realities of where the angel goes. I mean, meaning to say, it's not for them to decide who the mother is, it's for God's law to decide, and that may not depend on what they think and what they say. And everything else. Now, again, I hope you understand this very obvious point. It is a very obvious point that the issue of gestational surrogacy, where the surrogate is not Jewish, is exactly the halachic problem of egg donation. Because, in other words, except in reverse, in the egg donation, the genetic egg donor was not Jewish and the gestational mother was Jewish. In the surrogacy, it's just the opposite. The egg donor is Jewish and the birth mother is not Jewish. So whatever your position is going to be for egg donation is going to be flipped around in gestational surrogacy. So if you take the position that in the cases of egg donation where the baby is carried by the Jewish mother, the kid is Jewish because the angel spent 9 months teaching Torah to a Jewish womb, so to speak, then, in the case of a non-Jewish surrogate, the child would not be Jewish, and the child would need a conversion because it was in a non-Jewish environment, right? In other words, it's the flip. It's the same situation. And if, because of the safek, you have to have a safek giyor, then you would have to have a safek giyor in that case as well. So it's conceptually exactly the same issue, except the positions are reversed, because in the case of the gestational surrogate, the birth mother is the goy, and the genetic mother is the Jew. It's the same type of problem. Now, I will say that surrogacy is much, much less common, even in the general world. It is much less common than egg donation. Egg donation is very, very common, but most people really don't like surrogacy, because, you know, they don't want another woman to carry their baby for nine months. Now, let me point out that with gestational surrogacy, however, you get into issues way beyond the Jew versus Goy. You get into potential incest issues. And let me explain how that is so. I don't want to say common, because the whole thing of surrogacy is not so common, but within the small world of surrogacy, it is often common that a sister offers to carry a baby for her sister. And sometimes a mother offers.
Carry the baby for the daughter.
Right, if a mother has the daughter had a hysterectomy or whatever it is. So mom, if mom is still relatively young, mom will carry the baby for daughter. Now, that is an enormously complicated problem, because here is the problem. According to halacha, if a man has sexual intercourse with his mother-in-law,
but they didn't.
Okay, that's going to be the question. No, I understand. I understand. I'm just presenting you what the issue is. If a man would have sexual intercourse with his mother-in-law, that would be incestuous, and the child would be a mamzer. The question becomes the following. It's kind of the same as a sperm donor question we discussed. And that is, okay, if man's sperm fertilizes his wife's egg, but the embryo is carried by mother-in-law, if that is treated as mother-in-law's child, you have a mamzer.
But no one thinks it's her child.
Well, very different than egg donation. She's carrying it for 9 months.
Exactly.
It's not like egg donation where, you know, nobody connects it to the egg donor. Here, she's carrying it for 9 months. Same thing with sister. According to halacha, this is a strange type of incest, because you wouldn't think it is. To have relations, if a man has relations with his wife's sister, that is treated as incestuous. So you got the same problem. Now, of course, the observant, wise student will say, hey, how could you... Yeah, right, what's the question? Right, 100%. Great, great question. And one of the answers that's given is that Rachel and Leah converted to Judaism when they became part of Jacob's family, and therefore that erases the connection between them.
So they're not sisters anymore?
So they're not sisters anymore.
Sure. Can a woman carry an egg... Let's say her sister-in-law can't get pregnant.
Yeah.
Could she carry an egg with her sister-in-law's egg and her brother's sperm?
So that's exactly the issue that I'm raising. I'm meaning to say that one of the major halachic disagreements, this is exactly the question, that any intercourse which would be halachically incestuous, does it prohibit that woman from carrying the fertilized egg? That's exactly the issue. And that is why, because there's so much uncertainty, that's why I'm not giving you answers, I'm giving you questions. There is so much uncertainty about that status that one should avoid having a mother be a surrogate. One should avoid having a sister be a surrogate. In fact, one should avoid a married woman being a surrogate, because of potentially the adultery. And one should avoid a non-Jewish woman being a surrogate because of the conversion issue. So the only one woman that could be a surrogate is a single Jewish woman. Which is never an ideal candidate anyway,
unless
because
she's had her own kids.
That's right, because we don't want single women to get pregnant, right? So that's meaning the only woman. What this is called catch 22.
Medically, it's a problem.
Well, it's medically possibly a problem.
If you haven't already had your own kids, emotionally it can end up.
Yeah,
being
okay,
a
that's a good point. But this is the classic catch 22. Mm-hmm. The only surrogate that does not have halachic problems is a surrogate that it's not advisable to use, and that from a moral perspective many rabbis would highly discourage, because they would discourage single unwed women from getting pregnant, because it looks like they're, you know, not doing proper behaviors. So I would have to say that the bottom line is that Jewish law would discourage the use of gestational surrogates, both because of conversion problems if the surrogate is not Jewish, and because of potential incest problems if the surrogate is a close relative or even a married woman, because it might be considered adultery with the married woman. Okay, and to a single Jewish woman who could be a good surrogate, but number one, there are some medical and psychological issues, and number two, there's also the moral opprobrium, the moral condemnation of having single women. Remember, we discussed single women using sperm banks and the like, and many rabbis did not encourage it. Now, I've also seen, although I think it's a little bit of a weak argument, I also saw an argument against surrogacy from Rabbi Moshe Tendler, who's a very, very well-known bioethicist. And he said the following. He said that getting pregnant and carrying a baby to term is endangering your health. And even though it is permitted if you're going to have a child that you're going to raise, but he said it is prohibited to endanger your health for something that's not going to be your child. In other words, he basically said you're not allowed to just get pregnant to give the baby away. And he predicated it not on adultery and not on incest and not on all of the complicated questions I'm raising. He predicated it simply on the halachic obligation to safeguard your health, which may be set aside for the mitzvah of having children, but if you're not going to raise the child, you're not allowed to endanger your health. That's an interesting kind of out of left field type of reason.
Yeah, how is that any different than a man taking a job like working on high buildings? He's getting paid to endanger himself, but he can still take
for
a job.
For the purpose of his family.
Yeah, but
not the first family.
Also, you could say the woman also got paid for this.
Okay, well, I tell you, you might have a point if she's actually getting paid. Now, remember, as I mentioned, in many places, it's illegal to pay her.
Yeah.
So maybe I have to go back. Maybe Rabbi Tendler was referring to her doing it for free. If she's getting paid, it might be equivalent to a dangerous job.
What about for yourself? Like, if it's going to endanger your health?
Well, okay, the truth is every pregnancy is potentially dangerous. I don't want to scare you, but generally speaking...
Not at all. We've heard so much.
Okay. But generally speaking, if there's a unique danger to a woman's health, not just the general pregnancy risk...
Like, it might be life or death, she shouldn't be...
Absolutely, she should not, get pregnant, absolutely. Well, that's a decision. That is a decision that the family is allowed to make. They could say we want to have a baby, or they could, in other words,
like if someone has cancer, they like want to try to have a baby,
no, that's very true.
Right?
That's very true. And I think I had mentioned the halacha that if a pregnancy and a childbirth is endangering the mother's life, abortion is permitted. But if the mother says, "I would rather have the baby and die and leave over a baby," the mother is permitted to decline an abortion in order to enable her to have a live birth, even if she will die as a result.
She's allowed to do that?
Yes, she is. She is.
I thought you're not allowed to give up your life.
It's not generally speaking, you cannot give up your life, but you can give up your life in order to enable the baby to live.
So it's not considered suicide? Yeah.
Huh?
It's not considered suicide.
So it's not called suicide because it is called...
No, I know.
No, I understand. But the theory is this is a halachic category that in English we would call altruistic volunteerism, meaning to say you can't commit suicide, but just like a guard, you know, puts his life in danger to protect people, or do you remember that massacre in the schoolhouse? I mean, actually, in Israel, happens all the time, where sometimes even young teenagers will kind of put themselves in line of fire to protect. Or in Connecticut, when that crazy guy shot many children, so there was a teacher who kind of gave her life to protect the kids. So although you could say, well, that's suicide because she could have escaped, but there is a recognition in halacha that if you're giving your life for the purpose of protecting other people, you're not obligated. You have the right to escape if you want. But if you do give your life to help others, that's a meritorious, that's a good thing to do. So if the mother, and you understand their situation, this is a heart-wrenching dilemma. If the mother's going to die because of the pregnancy, that's usually because she's very, very sick and she's going to die soon anyway. So the cheshbon is very simple. What? Let's have an abortion so I'll live another 6 months and then I'll die? The mother will say, I'm going to die either now or 6 months from now. Let's have the kid and I'll die now. I mean, that's kind of the way it works.
Of a potential mother that in the foreseeable future is going to die anyway, or is this...
No, it would apply even a perfectly healthy mother if the pregnancy... Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is, though, that in the real world, the vast majority of cases where a woman will die as a result of the childbirth is because she's already very sick and likely to die soon anyway. So in most of the cases, her argument is going to be, emotionally, that why should I lose the chance to bring a child into the world to get another 6 months of life? Yeah, that's kind of the cheshbon, and she's allowed to make that decision. Now, if she doesn't make that decision, we do abort. We do abort the baby, even if it'll only keep her alive for another week. Mm-hmm. So we do... Her week is important enough, infinite. But all I'm saying is, yes, but she has the right. She does have the right to make the other decision. Okay, that's really important to understand. This is the notion of... Remember, I think I told you about the Titanic, a similar type of issue, where there's 11... The lifeboat can only hold 10 people, and if there's 11 people, it's going to break and sink, and they're all going to die. So if we know who the 11th guy is who came on the boat, we can throw him overboard, because he's endangering us. But if we don't know who number 11 is, we are not allowed to throw somebody over at random, because he could say... Yeah, but somebody can volunteer. Would you like to volunteer? No. But somebody can volunteer to give their life to save...
Someone can volunteer?
Yes.
Well, that's not called suicide.
It's not. That's the point. When I say somebody can volunteer, the meaning is it is not called suicide, because it is an attempt to save the lives of others, and that is altruistic volunteerism, which is permitted. It's a good question. In that particular case, indeed, you're giving your life to save many, to save more than one. On the other hand, in the case of the mother and the baby... On the other hand, you don't necessarily find a special rule for your child, right? In other words, I think theoretically it might apply to another child as well, you know? No, but even then, the whole discussion of the water bottle is what must you do? In other words, I don't have to give the other guy the bottle. But if I want to give the other guy the bottle, I'm allowed to do that. I mean, that would be our conclusion. Yeah. The point we're making is that you are allowed to give up your life to protect the life of another. You are not obligated to do so because your life is as good as his life, but you are permitted to save. Now, there were stories. Now, maybe this is not a proof, but you know, there was a great Hasidic Rebbe in Poland. The Ger Rebbe, you know, Ger is one of the biggest Hasidus, second to Chabad. But anyway, the Germans were looking for the Ger Rebbe. They were looking. They wanted to hunt him down because they knew he was like the leader of the Jews in Poland. And they burst into a house where the Rebbe was staying upstairs. And they demanded, "Where is the Rebbe?" And a man stepped forward and said, "I am the Rebbe." He wasn't. And he got killed immediately. And I mean, what was that? I mean, he basically got himself killed in order to save the Rebbe.
And he's allowed to do that because he volunteered.
So the theory would be, the halachic analysis would be that this was not just suicide, this was a desire to save the life of someone great, and that would be permitted. Now, I still understand that we still haven't answered All right, so I can give my life to save somebody great. I can give my life to save many people. I can give my life to save my child. All of my examples are not simply, I'll give my life to save a guy who's just like me. You still don't have an exact proof for an equal situation. But I think by analogy we would apply it to all of those cases. Okay. Now let me just mention the final surrogacy, which is really not that complicated. So we talked about egg donation, we talked about gestational surrogacy. Now the third category is where the surrogate is both the donor of the egg and the one who carries the egg. Mary Beth Whitehead, if the surrogate is not Jewish, it's pashut, that the kid is not Jewish. In other words, let's take Mary Beth Whitehead. Dr. Stern, who is a Jewish man, fertilizes this non-Jewish woman's egg, which the non-Jewish woman then carries for 9 months. There, you have no Shiloh. The genetic mother is non-Jewish, and the birth mother is not Jewish because it's the same woman. So there, for sure, no question, for sure, the child would need a conversion, because even though Dr. Stern is the biological father, but so what? Jewish status is based on the mother. It is not based on the father, and therefore the child would need conversion. So halachically, that does not pose any issue at all. But still, halacha would discourage this for the very simple reason that if Mary Beth was a married woman, number one, you have halachic incest. Halachic adultery.
But
adultery.
If she's not Jewish? Yeah.
Well, it's still adultery. The sin of adultery might be committed, etc. The kid wouldn't be a mamzer. But
I thought there's a Jewish couple who isn't halachically married.
Yeah.
And one of them cheats, then it's not a mamzer because it wasn't a halachic wedding.
It's not a mamzer, but it's still. Oh no no. But who says they weren't halachic? Who says the Sterns were not halachically married? I was assuming they were. If Mr. and Mrs. Dr. and Mrs. Stern are married halachically, let's assume. So for Stern's sperm to fertilize Mary Beth Whitehood's. I'm getting mixed up. No. Let me explain. I see your question. Let me explain the difference. If two Jews are not married halachically, that's not a marriage, and being with the wife is not adultery. You're right. However, halacha recognizes the validity of non-Jewish marriages between non-Jews under the Noahide Code. And now I understand. So as a result, Mary Beth Whitehead, as a non-Jew, who is married to her non-Jewish husband, does have a halachically recognized marriage, so that if I were to be with her, I would be committing halachic adultery. That's the difference. In other words, there's a difference between Jews who are not married halachically and non-Jews who are not married halachically, because non-Jews don't have to be married halachically, and therefore we recognize the Noahide Code recognizes their marriages. Right? That would be the difference. Okay, so I hope I thoroughly confused you. Actually, I hope I didn't, but just to be aware of these complexities. Now, just to make things even a little more complicated, and Baruch Hashem, we're not here yet, let's consider a technology that has not yet been used, but people talk about it, and that is cloning, producing a child through cloning. Now, we've produced a sheep through cloning, we've produced cats and dogs through cloning, although for some reason I think a dog is easier to clone than a cat. Cats are so independent, you can't even clone them, but I don't know why. But cats are difficult to clone. There have been rumors
that Molly wasn't cloned.
Dolly, that's correct. By the way, Dolly. Oh yeah, Dolly was a cloned sheep. Dolly the sheep was cloned.
There are rumors that she wasn't.
Really?
That the owner lied.
Oh, really?
Don't change my life.
No,
that's
no.
Like biology lesson.
I'll look that up, because there are whole books about Dolly. In fact, Gina Colada, who was the science reporter for the New York Times, wrote a whole book on the cloning of Dolly. So she actually describes there that Dolly had this big sense that she was like the most important sheep in the world. So
how did she know?
She somehow, like at times of feeding, she would like stand on her hind legs, and she expected to be fed first. No, she just had a sense of, I don't know. She had a sense of great importance, Dolly did. You know, okay. Anyways, it reminds me of another story I just read about a deer. A deer was run over, and its two front legs were broken. But it managed to hobble over to a hospital emergency room. I don't know how...
How did it know?
It walked in. I mean, obviously it was an accident, but it was near a hospital, so it just walked into the emergency room. So people are saying it's the world's smartest deer. You know? Okay. But it's not so smart. They took the deer out and they shot it. Okay, so I don't know. Okay.
Oh, no.
Right.
Why did it...
I mean, it goes all the way to the emergency room, but okay. Anyway.
This is a true story.
Yeah. This is a true story. Absolutely.
Oh, no, it's...
Absolutely. But anyway... to be sure that everybody understands this, let me be sure everyone knows what cloning is. Okay, you have to know what cloning is, and then you see what the idea is. This is very amazing. Every single cell in your body has the DNA encoding for the whole organism. In your skin cell, there is the DNA for kidneys and for liver and for brain. And in your brain cell is the DNA for skin and liver and the like. And that's why it's stem cells. And then eventually, as the cells differentiate, there's a very mysterious on and off system where the skin cell shuts off the encoding for liver, kidney, and the like. That's called cell differentiation, right? You have stem cells, and then there's cell differentiation. It was thought... It was thought that once cells have specialized, it was irreversible. You could not take a specialized cell. You could not take a skin cell and revert it back into something else. But in Dolly, if it happened, or at least the theory of cloning, is that you can actually reverse the differentiation of cells. And the way it works is the following. And you need an egg for this. How would, if Dolly was cloned, and again I have to say, but the way Dolly was supposed to have been cloned, and the fancy word for cloning is somatic cell nuclear transfer. So if you want to impress your date, ask him if he knows about SCNT, because that is the sophisticated language of cloning. And the way that works is, you take a... Take a somatic cell. SCNT, somatic cell nuclear transfer. I'm sure it'll come up in the course of the conversation. Now, what happens is this. You take the egg of the woman, strip out the nucleus of the egg, replace it with a fully differentiated cell from a... It could be from a man, it could be from another woman, it could be from the woman herself. And that cell that goes into the egg is not 50% of the chromosomes. A normal nucleus of an egg is 50% of the chromosomal material that joins to the sperm. Here, you don't need sperm, you don't need men, you don't need a male factor at all. You have a complete genome, a complete DNA in that egg. And then it replicates, it splits, it develops. And then it's transferred to a uterus. And after 9 months, you have a genetic copy of that cell. Now, here is the thing. Do you understand that this is reproduction without sperm? This is reproduction without a male factor. Men are not needed to produce children in the world. Women are needed because it is the egg that is the medium for allowing the cellular splitting. But sperm is not needed. Now, a man could be the one who donates. So cloning is a way that a couple could have the closest thing to a biological child. I'll give you one example of where cloning might be a useful thing. Let's imagine you have a Holocaust survivor. And the Holocaust survivor is the last member of his family. All of his family has been wiped out. And let's say he is a victim of Nazi experimentation. Maybe he's been castrated or sterilized. He cannot now, less. Now, he's castrated. There's no way he can have a biological kid, we would think. Now, adoption is of course possible, but a person also wants to continue the biological line. So look how cloning would work. Person doesn't even have sperm. The person is castrated, God forbid. But what could happen is, wife's egg, strip the nucleus out of the egg, take from the man a skin cell, put it in the egg. The embryo has now been created through a cloning, an asexual cloning process.
But then it's all him. Yeah.
So then it's all him. So here's the point.
Can you recombine DNA from the two cells?
Well, that would be much more complicated. In pure cloning, all the DNA is from one source, but the woman does have the 9 months of gestation, which spiritually is very important, and the egg, but the and the egg,
no,
and mitochondria, here's mitochondrial DNA.
But it wouldn't have her mitochondrial DNA.
Yeah, it would. No, it would.
It has her egg.
It's her egg. No, that's 100% correct. What you're saying is 100% correct.
Scooping out the nucleus.
Yeah, but the mitochondrial is not in the nucleus. It's in the outer part of the egg. Yeah, I don't want to get too technical on people because I'm going to reach the level of my ignorance if I go a little further. But the basic idea is that the DNA that is responsible for your characteristics, your hair color, your height, whatever is in your DNA, that all comes from one source. But that's the nucleus of the egg, and since the nucleus was removed, it'll be replaced by the somatic cell. But there is mitochondrial DNA that is still coming maternally, as well as 9 months of gestation and hormonal influences and the like. So isn't this amazing? So through a cloning process, a person could have a child. Now, let me tell you something even more amazing. Now, you had said, but the problem is it's not really genetically the mother's child in any way other than...
Can you do it to a sperm?
He doesn't have sperm.
Can you take someone else's sperm and pull out the DNA and insert his DNA?
No, it's only one.
It has to be a complete. If you're doing that, you're just doing artificial insemination. I mean, if you strip out the nucleus, it's not going to work. You can't put sperm in a denucleized egg.
You wouldn't denuclease the egg.
Sperm's
then it's just artificial insemination. Then I mean,
is it possible to do it with his DNA?
So let me tell you. Let me tell you the new step, and this is really more for biology people, and that is, it was recently discovered that from your somatic cell, they could unravel the double helix of the DNA. Remember, every cell in your body is a combination of your mother and father, the sperm and the egg. It then wraps up in a double helix shape. If you can unravel the double helix, you've created sperm out of a skin cell.
At that point,
you can fertilize the egg without taking out the nucleus, and you can actually create sperm by unraveling the DNA strands.
Skin cells diploid and sperm cells are haploid, so how would you separate out one of each chromosome from the diploid skin cells?
I don't know the process. I mean, maybe it wouldn't be skin cells, but what I did read was that they've taken somatic cells and they have created sperm out of them by unraveling the helix. I don't know exactly the technology. But with cloning, you don't need a male factor, although it can be used as a male factor, obviously. So that's an interesting point. If the donor of the somatic cell was a woman, might be the woman herself or another woman, so the question becomes, is the mother the father? Meaning to say, you have a birth... In other words, you have at least three people here. You have a birth mother, you have an egg donor, and you have the genetic contributor. You have three different people who might be mothers. Now, let's imagine. Okay, maybe I should wait, maybe I should hold this over for next week, because I want to raise a lot of interesting questions about cloning, and maybe it's a little brain overload. Well, we've gone long enough in this, but we'll talk about the issue of what is the status of cloning.
Should open the floor to any like random questions.
Yeah. Okay. Any random questions?
What do you have?
What do you think about egg donation? I don't think we really summed it up,
did we? Okay, so the summary of egg donation is this.
Do
again, basically, many, many people do it. It's kind of a practice in the Orthodox community, so one cannot deny that it's done. But many rabbis have halakhic problems with it. If the egg donor is not Jewish, which is going to be the assumption in the United States, you have issues of giyur misafek. If the egg donor is married, you have the potentials of adultery and all of those issues. So the basic orientation of many, many rabbis is that they don't like to get third parties involved in the creation of families. You know, if you're doing your own IVF and you're doing your own insemination with the husband's semen, that is fine and that can work out. But it's better not to create those types of blended family things because of the mix-ups that are there. It's not as bad as surrogacy. Surrogacy is even worse because you actually have a woman carrying that baby for 9 months. But it does raise all of the same types of questions. Okay, so God willing, we should all merit to have our children the good old-fashioned, normal way, and to raise them for the coming of Mashiach. Okay. All right. So we'll see you in 2 weeks. I'm not going to be here next week. Thank you. Thank you so much.